Mikey05, welcome back to this week's Worth of Course content. We have a little bit of a different structure to this week's stuff. We're going to be having a guest lecturer come in and I'll be giving you some details about your guest lecturer. We also now have your first assignment has been submitted. We're in the process of going through those right now, and I'm really impressed with some of the ones I've seen so far. I think many of you really have taken some time to really consider what was being asked of you, and those grades should be seen probably early next week, maybe the end of this week, depending on how things are working out with our TAs. We're extremely excited what's in store for us this week. Keep in mind, keep your form and auto response questions going. You're doing a good job on that so far. So, with that all being said, we are going to be joined by a really exciting person here, Jeff Schoenberg. He is a really interesting figure, especially in the world of nonprofits. He joined us to discuss his work in the sport industry. Currently, he works with Deloitte. He's here to speak more about his role evaluating board organizations. He's a co-author in one of the articles, two of the articles that you'll be reading this semester. One of them that is reading that you're going to be doing this week. It's an analysis of the sports sector and the governance in the sports sector in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And in fact, your form response this week will be based on that article. And I was going over these articles that he's written for us. He also did the gender and board diversity slides that you saw were also cited from him. And I wanted to actually just reach out to him and see if he couldn't connect with us one-on-one and try and bring this a little bit more lively or off the page than just simply having to read his articles. And I won't lie. I mean, it is a difficult part of the process of going through university is reading secondary literature. It is a part that I don't think is anyone's maybe perhaps their favorite. But this is, again, good training in general. These are documents that you're going to have to analyze and make sense of, even if it's language that you're not terribly used to. And certainly by third year university, you should be used to reading an academic article. But again, we don't have a ton of those assigned this semester. This week, we do have one that I need you to look at. So have a look through that article. You have the full week to do it. But we're having a little bit of a better understanding now of what a nonprofit is and how it functions. This is a great example of how this article is a great example of how nonprofits are structured, how NSOs are structured. Many of you are about to work for NSOs. Some of you are working for more local organizations. So it's important to know how these structures are governed. And again, in terms of governance, I am also assuming that you have a base level of understanding based on your previous undergraduate training in other courses. Maybe you've been fortunate enough to have a governance course. In other words, with Mike Van Bussel or others. I mean, we have some really awesome governance instructors here at Brock. So I'm suspecting that you have some level of experience with the word governance or essentially what that means, but it's important to sort of get this dialed into what governance means for a nonprofit of an NSO and how they all work, especially as if you're about to go work with a nonprofit specifically. So that's the sort of write-up for the form response article that you're going to be reading this week, and this is a bit more of a wide-ranging conversation today with Jeff. I think it's about more. He actually offers some pretty good career advice towards the end of this year, and your audio response is going to be based off of this as well. And I think that it's an enjoyable conversation. So with that being said, I'll get out of the way here and bring on the conversation that me and Jeff had about his experience in the sports industry and what makes an effective board member and how nonprofits do. We are joined now by Jeff Schoenberg. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're up to right now.
I'm more based in Toronto, although I am not a Torontonian. I'm from Calgary originally, and I'm doing some consulting work with different national sporting organizations. So right now, my clients include the Curling Canada as well as Climbing Canada, and I've done some work with the Canadian Olympic Committee across a few different sports and projects there. Before living in Toronto, I actually spent 10 years in Australia, where right before I left, I was working for Sport Australia as a senior consultant in their governance team. And before that, I spent about a decade, you know, almost 10 years in academia. And I did my master's over there, my PhD over there. And then I did a postdoc as well. And my work is all focused very much on sport governance. So boards of directors, relationships between organizations and memberships, constitutions, bylaws, that sort of thing.
Fantastic. So what was your earliest sort of involvement in sport? How did you first get involved in sport as maybe as even a someone who played or even at the administrative level?
Yeah. So, you know, I played a bunch of different sports growing up. I played a bit of soccer, would have been my main sport. But I kind of stopped playing around when I was 12 or 13. I got cut from a team because I was too small to be a goalie, which at the time I thought was unjust. But looking back at it now, I would have been like, I don't know, too short to be a goalie. So fair enough. I started a couple of years later refereeing soccer as a way to make a bit of pocket money. And then after that, when I was 16, I started coaching and really enjoyed coaching and ended up doing that for about 10 years as well as refereeing. When I finished high school, I went off to the University of Calgary and I was all set to be a math teacher until I realized that I'm pretty good at math, but I don't really like it that much. And I can't imagine spending the rest of my life thinking about math. So that's when Mount Royal University was just starting a program called the Bachelor of Applied Business and Entrepreneurship in Sport and Recreation, basically a sport management degree. And I went, oh, that sounds great. Because I knew like the kinesiology sports science place wasn't really for me, both in terms of too much focus on biology, I'm terrible at it. And the irony, you know, so many people, when you study kinesiology or sports science, you kind of have to get a master's to get much real work. And I was like, no, I want something more practical. And then eventually went on to the master's and PhD anyway. So yeah. And then through that undergraduate degree, I did a couple of internships. They call them direct field studies. So I did some work with the Calgary Blizzard Soccer Club. I did some work with Mount Royal College Cougar Athletics. I also worked one summer for the Alberta Soccer Association in running their summer camps. So was just sort of leveraging my skills that I developed through skills and network, really, from refereeing and coaching into sort of job opportunities, internships, summer jobs, things like that.
And when did you develop sort of an interest or even a research interest in nonprofits? Was it this initial experience with working with them, like you mentioned with the Blizzard Soccer and things like that?
No, I'll be honest. So when I went to do my master's, you know, part of that involved doing some research. And the reason I wanted to do my master's isn't any sort of noble pursuit of new knowledge or self-improvement. I looked around me and I looked at the people who were, you know, CEOs or executive directors of sport organizations. So, you know, your Triathlon Ontario's or your Volleyball Nova Scotia's or things like that, or even, you know, at a higher level, really the national sporting organizations and professional sports and things like that. And you look at the people who are running those organizations, and for the most part, they all either had a master's degree or they had been an ex-elite athlete. And I was definitively not an ex-elite athlete, not a current elite athlete. And so I went, if I want to be in leadership of those organizations, I'm gonna need a master's degree to compete. So that's when I went to do my master's degree. My research that I planned on focusing was, again, in a very creative, strategic way, my original proposals around the career paths of CEOs of sporting organizations. So essentially, what did people do that led them to become CEOs of sporting organizations? And then I figured I would just copy that and become a CEO. But as I started to do that work, and my supervisor at the time sort of guided me and said, there's not much, you know, theoretical value in just looking at, you know, how much is education important versus experience, blah, blah, blah. He said, let's flip it on its head. Rather than what's the career path of CEOs, let's think about how boards of directors of these not-for-profit sport organizations make the selection of who their CEO is going to be. And that's sort of what introduced me into the world of governance and the governance of not-for-profit organizations, is that sort of shift from just looking at how the CEO gets their job to the actual theory and strategic decision-making behind the selection of a CEO. And then it just sort of expanded from there. When I went to do my PhD, it sort of wanted to go deeper into the governance area. And that's sort of where I developed, you know, I get a little weird using the term, but I guess an expertise in that field.
Well, my students have read your article. You certainly are an expert in this field. It's a fantastic article. They've even heard you speaking, explaining your dissertation work there. You know, it's funny hearing you go back, and your experience there is so valuable, I think, to hear for many of my students who are in a similar situation that you're in, that maybe they want to work in sport, maybe they're not an elite athlete, but maybe they know that, you know, many of the people that run these organizations were elite athletes. And this is a seemingly tough world to break into. If you could go back to that first, you know, impressions you had of non-profit organizations, what were your first initial impressions that you can remember when you started working with nonprofits?
Wow. So one of the things that it comes to mind is one of my first jobs when I was finishing up my degree is I worked with a small consulting company. And by small consulting company, I mean, there was the boss and me. And we were basically trying to provide administrative services to local sport organizations. So working with the local soccer club to do their registration, helping the lacrosse club run their tournament, et cetera, et cetera. And really what you realized is, one, how volunteer driven, you know, local sport is. You kind of know it, but unless you're some of the big clubs out there, most clubs are very reliant on volunteer work. And at the same side, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always skilled volunteer work. People who are volunteering often do so with great passion for the organization, for the club, for the group that they're working with. But they have other jobs. They have other expertise. They might have just been the last one to get out of the room when somebody was asking who's going to organize this next event. And so that challenge, when you see those organizations, you realize like it doesn't take a lot to make a valuable contribution to them. And the leadership, by providing any sort of basic upskilling services, you can actually make things a lot easier for folks.
That's fantastic. And that need for volunteers is something that we're going to be getting into this semester, and how best to facilitate good volunteers. But one of the things that's really fascinating about your research is in the board itself, and how much research you've done into what a good board looks like and what board behaviors are effective. When did you start developing a research interest in how boards work?
Yeah, so that was very much the natural extension of the master's degree. So the master's degree looked at how boards made a specific decision, hiring their CEO. And the next work, the PhD, started to look at, well, how do boards function best? And now the field of sport governance, you know, it's certainly bloomed right now in terms of a research area. It's very popular. There's a lot of people trying to understand governance. It's still not as popular as marketing or, you know, a lot of other, you know, sexier, more fun topics. But what I sort of observed in the governance realm is that there'd been a lot of work that started to identify almost, I like to call them like the structural elements of what good governance looks like. So, you know, we've recognized that you shouldn't have a board that, you know, a board of 25 people is not going to be effective in making decisions. Representative boards. So when you think of a national sporting organization, let's think of Volleyball Canada, you know, having that board be made up of the presidents of each of the provincial sport organizations is not good governance. So there'd been a lot of research out there around what are the structural elements that makes good governance. But really, at the end of the day, a governance is a group of people coming together to make decisions. Well, anytime you have a group of people coming together, there's going to be the group dynamics and the actual behaviors of the group can really dictate a lot of what happens. You know, I'm sure everyone has an example of where there's, you know, a policy written down and the way things should be done. You know, you think of a lot of the jobs you do when you're younger in retail or service industries that have these policies that management has written, but in reality, it doesn't always necessarily look like that. And it's similar in governance. You can put in all the perfect policies, you can have all the right rules, you can have all the right guidelines, but at the end of the day, it's still a group of people coming together to make decisions. And I was fascinated to try to understand a little bit more about how that works, particularly because governance is very much the critical part of an organization. Everyone likes to point at a CEO and go, well, there's the person who's got all the power, but in not-for-profit sport organizations, it's usually a volunteer board of directors who is responsible for the CEO, and they can fire the CEO if they want. They sort of say, this is the strategic direction we want. These are the outcomes we're looking for. And it's up to the CEO to go get that. So if you don't have good governance in place with the organization, you know, it doesn't, there's a quote from John Wiley, who's a former chairperson of Sport Australia, to the effect of, good governance doesn't guarantee success, but poor governance certainly guarantees failure. You know, you're not going to win gold medals because you have good governance, but you're definitely not going to win good gold medals if you have bad governance. And so the more and more that I've seen governance in action in the different organizations I've worked with, now having worked with local clubs, provincial sporting organizations, sort of multi, not sport events, but like not-for-profit major events, and national sporting organizations, the more you go, governance is pretty important. And it's critical that we get that in place, and understanding how people actually act within those environments is one part of the challenge in having effective governance.
That's fantastic. Great stuff. I mean, you have such a varied experience in terms of working with organizations and you know, doing consulting work yourself. And I don't wish to, you know, give away your secret sauce here, but when you arrive at a nonprofit, are there things that when you arrive on day one that you look at and you think, that's not going to, are there tendencies that you see that are like, oh, this is not going to be an easy switch? And on the other side, are there things that when you arrive on day one, you say, okay, well, thank goodness we have this at this nonprofit. Are there tendencies, positive and negative, that you can normally see on day one?
So there's a couple of different things that come to mind here, and I might not answer the question directly, but I'll speak about things that I'm sure that are relevant. So one of the things is that everyone, as much as there will be debate, conflict, bad dynamics around maybe a decision, or there's tensions within a not-for-profit, one of the critical things to remember is almost universally, everybody is there and everybody wants to see that organization have success. Now, what success looks like might be different for different groups, but nobody who's on the board of Dragon Boat Racing Canada or Pickleball British Columbia has an interest in seeing the organization do poorly. The staff who work at those organizations aren't trying to sabotage anything. Everybody wants there to be success. And it's sometimes hard for people to remember that just because somebody disagrees with what their perspective is, that's they're not trying to sabotage the organization. I think there's a tendency in a lot of not-for-profit organizations sometimes to try to make changes based on logic and rational arguments. So trying to go, all right, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of organizations doing now is, and it's most of them have got there, but it's still not universal, you know, online registration systems, right? And going, when you sign up for your club, instead of dropping off a form that you filled out with pen and a check, actually signing up and paying online. Now, you see groups trying to make that change, and you see them trying to say, hey, we're the provincial sporting organization, and we're going to make sure that all of our clubs now sign up using this way. And they try to sort of make a rule that says, this is what you must do. But people find ways around those rules, or they cause us other problems down the lines, because they'll start a fight in different ways, or they'll try to rebel against the intention of the rule, or they'll pick out different issues. When really, what you need to understand is you need to adopt the perspective of the person who's being impacted. So many not-for-profit organizations, and one of the tensions between, say, the staff of an organization who work on stuff full-time, who get paid to do so, who aren't necessarily, you know, some people have been in the sport for a very long time, but oftentimes the CEO of a sport organization, you know, the only attachment they have to that sport is being in that role. And they're working with boards of directors, you know, volunteers who have grown up within the sport, who have learned the way we do things, who have an institutionalized way of going about stuff. You know, some clubs, the same person's been the president or the treasurer for 5, 10, 15 years. And who is it for this staff person to come in and say what they should be doing? So there's a tension there that happens. And if you're going to try to make change, you need to start to bring them along with it. You know, I go in when I work with different boards of directors, particularly, like, I can usually see what needs to be changed, what tweaks might really help make their meetings more productive. But if I just write a paper and send it to them and say, here, we've had a conversation. I've watched a couple of your board meetings. Here's a report on what you should do, and walk away. Things don't end up happening. Whereas if I sit with people and say, all right, for the next board meeting, I want people to try filling out this paperwork in advance. So we're going to have, instead of the executive director give a oral report, they're going to write it down. And then at the meeting, they might just speak about it for a couple of minutes, but it'll be more about questions. Let's try it that way. And if you walk people through the process, it helps them get there a lot better. So my goal is really to, when I'm working with organizations, is to generally help them get to the answers that I already know in advance.
That is, you answered my question perfectly. That's fantastic. Those are, you answered even in a more practical sense about an actual skill that you can help the organizations develop themselves, because these students are actually going to be working with nonprofits themselves. Some of them are far more organized and developed than others, but I think that's fantastic advice. And you know, on that same topic, you know, what advice, if you have any, would you offer students who are learning about nonprofits perhaps for the first time? Do you have any memories of learning about this, or maybe being a student yourself? And is there anything you could offer as advice to our students here in 3P05?
It is impossible to overestimate how valuable good Microsoft Excel skills can be. Like, the amount of these organizations and people working within these places who have terrible Microsoft Excel skills, and just a simple spreadsheet, like, if you can do a pivot table, it can change everything. I worked for one organization where I was working with Northwest Ringette in Calgary and doing their ice scheduling for their practices. And using pivot tables, because people always complained, you know, particularly those of us who, I mean, I'm not a hockey person, but I know of the ice shortage that we have. So people would have, you know, 5:30 a.m. practices on the weekend for Ringette. And they would always complain that they're getting way more early mornings practices than the other teams. And I was able to do this simple report so that each month would be able to report and say, hey, here's how many times this team had, you know, an early morning practice. Here's how many times they had the full ice. Here's how many times the shared ice. Here's how many times, like, all these different things. And it just made everybody far more comfortable. And there was nothing particularly creative with that. It was just Microsoft Excel. So that's a very specific practical thing. I think the more broader, like, and that's just not even applicable just to nonprofits. That's just applicable for any sort of job you're looking at doing. I think it's important to recognize that, and this is, again, this probably isn't specific to not-for-profit, but it's more pronounced in not-for-profit support. Especially early in your career, this is not a 9-to-5 job. Sport happens in the evenings and on the weekends. And a lot of the people, when you're in your early career work, you know, if you're a community engagement coordinator or a club development officer or any sort of, an admin support, events management, you know, all these different sort of entry level jobs, you're working with people who more than likely are volunteers in some way, shape or form. Or if they're paid, they're, you know, coaches who get paid to coach nights and weekends. So just, you can do a lot of the work out of time, but recognizing that there is going to be, it's going to infringe on that evening and weekend time, because that's when sport happens. And that's when volunteers are available, because a lot of them have other jobs that they've got to do during the day. If they can't have a meeting, they're going to have to do a committee meeting on Tuesdays at 7 p.m. And that's just the reality of it.
And your experience, you have sort of had experience in both the nonprofit world and with some sports that have professional arms or even professional sport themselves. How would you articulate the difference between the two worlds if you were trying to imagine the difference between nonprofit work and work in the professional sporting sector?
I've not worked much in the professional sport. You know, I'm doing some work with Curling Canada now, which obviously has some level of professionalization to it. Not quite the same as professional leagues or things like that, but there's, you know, there's a lot more money in curling than there is in some of the other sports. Well, in Canada anyway, not a lot of money in Australian curling. I want to be clear there. Professional sport organizations are very much, it takes a long time before you matter when you're working in a professional sporting organization. There's so many people who, you know, we're in Ontario, so I'm going to guess that there's a lot of folks right now who, you know, their dream job is to be a game day or a marketing person for the Leafs, right? I grew up in Calgary. At least half, if not three quarters of my cohort wanted to be working for the Flames. And actually, one of my very best friends who ended up doing the same degree I did ended up working for the Flames, and he worked for them for about 10 years. But those first couple of years, I don't even know how many, he was, you know, game day and events operations for the Flames and for the Hitmen, the junior team. And so that meant, you know, about 60 nights a year he would have to work the game. And, you know, once in a while maybe he doesn't need to come into the office for the night, you know, at 9 a.m the normal start time, but for the most part he's still there every single day. That's a lot more time, it's a lot more work, and it's highly competitive. When he got that job, he was actually working as like a programs manager or something like that at Cardell Place, a really big multi-sport venue that, you know, got a couple of rinks, swimming pool, all of that sort of stuff, gym, huge facility. So he was a programs manager there. He had to take a pay cut to go work for the Flames. So, you know, yes, if you eventually get to the top ranks within some of those professional sport organizations, the pay is great, but it takes a lot to get there, and it's going to take over your life a little bit. Not-for-profit sport organizations, you know, you just never make any money, so it's fine that way. But, you know, there is a little bit more of a little bit more of a balance and an understanding of the role there.
Fantastic, and again, that is really valuable insight about the pro sports industry, and this is something that I think that takes a little bit of a learning adjustment to realize that, you know, that the pro sport industry might have some, you know, job opportunities. There are career opportunities in the professional sports industry, but they are highly competitive. And that normally is code for low paying for the most part in those entry-level positions. You know, we've been looking at nonprofit career opportunities frequently as well. And it is remarkable that, you know, certainly, you know, among volunteers, there is no obviously reimbursement for those kinds of things. But one of the things that we've noted is that you mentioned something really crucial there. You said it takes a long time for you to matter to a professional sports organization. There are reasons for that I think that are quite obvious to most of us that look at this. However, with nonprofits, the most remarkable thing is you can gain experience very quickly and you become indispensable very quickly. And that's something that if you ever did want to make the jump to the professional sports industry, it's hard to do that without a robust resume. Right. And that's something that certainly we've addressed so far in this course, is that, you know, working with nonprofits like you're doing in this course, it gives you a very, very, very variable skill set. Microsoft Excel being one of them. I'm glad you mentioned that. that's a valuable. That is true. It just everywhere. My goodness. You want to make someone's head spin. Just know how to use the Office suite. I mean, Adobe suite, let alone. But the Office suite. Holy moly. Having good office skills. Necessary for any job in any industry, frankly. But so that was great that you shared that moment where you realize, okay, I actually can make a difference at this organization. That's far easier to do at a nonprofit than in pro sports. Can you speak to that, sort of how easy it is to become indispensable at a nonprofit?
Yeah, I mean, these are not-for-profit organizations. One of the big challenges that these sporting bodies have is they're low resources. There's not a lot. They don't have tons of money. They don't have tons of staff. So you do end up pretty quickly knowing a lot about the organization and a lot about the business that you're running, the sport that you're running. we talk about there's very few CEOs in waiting within a national sporting organization or in a provincial sporting organization, because if you're good enough to be a CEO, there's somewhere that will hire you to be a CEO. And because of that, because you're running entire provincial sporting organizations with, say, three people, you really quite quickly learn everything about the organization. You're attached into a whole bunch of different areas, and you're learning, you know, how to do the administrative work, like running a registration system, et cetera. You're learning about club development. Okay, how do we roll out a new resource that clubs can use to help? You know, you think in Ontario with all the stuff around Rowan's Law and concussion safety, all right? Learning how to roll out that sort of communications program is really important. You learn so many skills so quickly that it's valuable. And that's, you know, it's from an employee standpoint, it's great because you can learn a bunch of skills, become pretty valuable in an organization, then you can move on and move up pretty quickly. It's tough for the not-for-profit sport organizations because, you know, if you only have three staff and somebody's performing great, well, there's really nowhere for them to go. There's no promotion opportunities unless somebody's looking at resigning already. But that's one of the challenges that you are likely going to have to move around a little bit from a student perspective, from an employee perspective or employee perspective. That's great. That's fine. And it's actually, one of my undergraduate professors said something that stuck with me quite a while, and I'll relate what he said here. Is a professor named Dr. Pavalka. He taught in like the ecotourism space, really, really interesting way that he thought about sport and all of that. But he sort of said, you know, you're going to graduate soon and you're going to have this inkling, you're going to have this desire to buy a couch and a painting. And he said, you're going to want to buy those things because when you graduate, you feel a little bit less sure as what you're supposed to do. There's no end goal of working, right? I mean, retirement, but that's along with that. You know, in a degree, you go semester to semester, course by course until you finish your degree. There's something anchoring you there. So he says a couch and a painting is a way of saying I'm an adult and I have stuff now that gives me a sense of belonging. He said, avoid doing that. The best thing you can do is to go try to find a bunch of different contract work. So 3 months, 6 months, 12-month contracts, working in different parts of the country, working with different organizations, different parts of the world even. Because what ends up happening is you can quite quickly develop a range of skills, a range of contexts, and importantly, an understanding of what you're interested in and you're not interested in. One of the best things you can do as an undergraduate student is have a terrible internship where you just go, wait, I hated that. Okay, well, wait, why did I hate that? Maybe it's because you felt you were working on your own all the time. Maybe it was because there wasn't enough on-field action. Maybe that whatever it is, having a bad internship, you know, it's as important to understand what you don't want as understanding what you do want as you go forward.
Jeff, that is extremely valuable information, not just for, you know, 3P05, but for their entire journey through Brock here. I mean, many of these students are nearing the end here. They're in third year. Some of them are in fourth year. So that's just fantastic.
Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around. Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around. Said I don't want to leave you lonely. You gotta make me change my mind.